The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and from the Harvard Health Letter. And in fact, the first article comes from the Harvard Heart Letter, and it's entitled, Ask the Doctor. It comes from Deepak L. Bhatt, MD, who's the editor-in-chief. Blood thinners after a stent. How long? I had 3 drug-coated stents implanted 5 years ago following a heart attack and have been taking low-dose aspirin and Prasugrel, which is also called Effient, ever since. My doctor has suggested that I could stop taking the Effient. Is there any benefit in remaining on it? When people receive stents, the tiny metal mesh tubes that help open narrowed arteries, doctors routinely prescribe aspirin along with another medication that prevents clots. These drugs include clopidogrel, which is called Plavix, Prasugrel, which is called Effient, and ticagrelor, which is called Brilinta. Like aspirin, they prevent blood components called platelets from sticking together and forming clots. Clots that form inside the stent, known as stent thrombosis, can lead to a heart attack. The combination of aspirin and one of those stronger antiplatelet drugs is known as dual antiplatelet therapy, or DAPT. The question of how long people should stay on DAPT has been a matter of debate for years. Current guidelines suggest at least 1 year in people who need an emergency stent and at least 6 months after a non-emergency stent procedure. But doctors may adjust this timeline based on an individual's specific situation. For example, people who receive a stent after a heart attack or acute coronary syndrome, a sudden loss of blood flow to the heart, may benefit from staying on the drugs for an additional period beyond the first year, potentially indefinitely. But that assumes they don't develop any major bleeding problems, the main side effect of DAPT. Major bleeding includes heavy bleeding in the stool or urine. People who develop major bleeding may need to stop taking the drugs sooner. Ideally, they should stay on DAPT for at least a month, if at all possible. Rarely, bleeding can occur in the brain, which can be a disabling or fatal complication. Nuisance bleeding, such as frequent gum bleeding or nosebleeds, can also occur. This might also warrant shortening the duration of DAPT. Another option your doctor may recommend is to stop taking the aspirin and continue taking only the other antiplatelet drug. Taking a proton pump inhibitor such as omeprazole or Prilosec, which is available over the counter, or prescription-only pantoprazole or Protonix, may help reduce the risk of gastrointestinal bleeding in people taking DAPT. But check with your doctor first. The decision to stay on DAPT should be reassessed by the doctor periodically as people grow older. With age, people often develop other conditions that raise their risk of bleeding, heart attack, or both. The next article, coming from the Harvard Heart Letter of May 2021, is entitled, Optimize Your Exercise Routine. Whether you're an exercise novice or a gym regular, these tips can help you get the most out of your workout. When it comes to exercise, timing is everything, but not in the way we normally think about timing. What matters most is making the time to exercise regularly, not when it happens. That said, Your personal experience and specific goals may influence what workout schedule works best for you. If you're just starting a physical activity routine, any time that you feel motivated and energized enough to exercise is the best time for you, says Dr. Beth Freites, clinical assistant professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation at Harvard Medical School. For some people, that's in the morning. For others, the afternoon works better. But if you can work out with a friend, choose a time that works best for both of you, she suggests. Teaming up with an exercise buddy is more enjoyable, and you can hold each other accountable. Exercising early in the day may have other advantages for reluctant or less enthusiastic exercisers. If you wait until later in the day, it weighs on you all day long, and you're more likely to come up with excuses for not exercising, says Dr. Freites. There's evidence that exercising the first thing in the morning, before breakfast, helps people burn more stored body fat. But does that actually help people lose more weight? The jury's still out on that question, says Dr. Freites. If you're trying to shed pounds, experiment on yourself. Exercise before breakfast for 4 weeks, then after breakfast for the next 4 weeks. See how you feel and whether one timing strategy helps you lose more weight than the other. Another potential benefit for early bird exercisers is taking advantage of the feel-good brain chemicals, dopamine and serotonin, that are released during physical activity. That sets you up for success throughout the whole day and may increase your concentration and creativity, says Dr. Freites. Some research also suggests that people who exercise in the morning are more careful with their food choices throughout the day. The argument for afternoon. But for other people, an afternoon workout has certain advantages. If you're not a morning person, you'll probably prefer exercising later in the day. Plus, your joints and muscles will probably feel more limber in the afternoon than in the morning. People often experience a mid-afternoon lull around 3 p.m. Instead of having a snack or a cup of coffee, use exercise as a way to re-energize yourself, Dr. Freites suggests. And if you're trying to lose or maintain your weight, try doing a short burst of exercise as a distraction when you're craving a treat, no matter what time of day that happens. It's best to wait at least 3 hours after a large meal before exercising. But if you have just a small meal or a snack, waiting an hour is fine. Highly trained athletes who want to boost their performance often like to have a small, carbohydrate-rich snack like a banana or a slice of whole grain toast shortly before their workout. Carbohydrates provide quick fuel for short, high-intensity exercise, Dr. Freites explains. Exercise, particularly morning exercise, can be challenging if you're dehydrated, which can happen when you're not drinking enough water throughout the day on a routine basis. In fact, if you're dehydrated and not well fed from the previous day, and you exercise before breakfast, you probably won't have enough energy for an enjoyable, effective workout. You might even become dizzy, which could be dangerous, warns Dr. Freites. Don't assume that simply drinking a big glass of water right before you exercise will do the trick. Drinking fluids throughout the day is important. Be sure to get at least 7 hours of sleep each night because this benefits your health in many ways, and exercise can help. People who exercise regularly tend to fall asleep more quickly at bedtime, spend less time falling asleep, as well as spend less time lying awake in bed during the night. If you've had a poor night's sleep for any reason, you might feel too tired to exercise. If that's the case, try taking a nap, ideally before 3 p.m., and for only 20 to 30 minutes, and exercise afterwards, says Dr. Freites. Finally, novice exercisers may find it easier to break their exercise into shorter chunks of time. Even 5 minutes at a time counts toward your goal of 150 minutes per week, says Dr. Freites. Build up your endurance gradually. Once you're able to exercise for 30 minutes at a time, you can ramp up your speed and intensity, which boosts your calorie burn and cardiovascular health. The next article offers some important advice. Suspected heart attack? Don't fear the emergency room due to COVID-19. In addition to a prompt assessment and potentially life-saving treatment, expect a COVID-19 test and extra safety precautions. Even before the pandemic, people with heart attack symptoms sometimes hesitated to seek emergency care. But during the first wave of COVID-19 infections in the early 2020, many more people than usual stayed away. From mid-March to late May 2020, emergency room visits for heart attacks fell by 23% compared with the preceding 10 weeks. And 20% fewer people showed up with strokes, according to the CDC. Fear of leaving home and risking exposure to the coronavirus likely explains this trend, which has abated over time. The overall volume in emergency rooms is still somewhat below normal, and we're seeing people who come in many hours or even a day after their heart attack symptoms began, says Dr. Joshua Kosowski, assistant professor of emergency medicine at Harvard Medical School. These people sometimes have a sign of heart damage that might have been easier to reverse or treat if they had come in right away, he adds. If you think you might be having a heart attack, call 911. If you're unsure or have misgivings, call your doctor's office for advice. In general, you'll find that primary care providers have a low threshold for sending their patients to the emergency room if there's any concern, says Dr. Kosowski. Once you're in the emergency room, any possible exposure to the coronavirus is likely far lower than at a crowded supermarket or on public transportation. Staff members take the safety precautions. They wear masks, gloves, and do social distancing. They take these precautions very seriously. Don't imagine a crowded waiting room with stretchers in the hallways, says Dr. Kosowski. Receiving a prompt evaluation and treatment for heart attack can prevent serious heart damage and may save your life. The constant updates about coronavirus fatalities tend to obscure the deadly toll from cardiovascular disease. But on average, about 655,000 Americans die of heart disease every year, which far exceeds the number who died as a result of complications due to COVID-19 over a 12-month period. These two serious health conditions are intertwined in other ways. For one, the problems that leave people vulnerable to heart disease, like high blood pressure, obesity, and diabetes, also put them at greater risk for complications from COVID-19. For another, two classic heart attack symptoms, chest pain and breathlessness, are also common symptoms of COVID-19. People who show up with those symptoms will be tested for COVID and asked to isolate until testing is negative, but their initial workup for a possible heart attack will otherwise be essentially the same as in the past, says Dr. Kosowski. Although your loved ones can't accompany you into the emergency room, you can stay in close contact with them with a mobile device, a cell phone or tablet, which are now widely used in these settings. The article goes on to remind you what heart attack symptoms are. They include discomfort, pressure, or a squeezing sensation, usually in the center of your chest, pain in one or both arms or shoulders, or in your back, neck, or jaw, a rapid or irregular heartbeat, trouble breathing, feeling lightheaded, dizzy, or weak, or feeling sick to your stomach, possibly vomiting. How do they diagnose a heart attack in the emergency room? Well, there are two main tests that you'll receive for a suspected heart attack. The first is an electrocardiogram. This measures the heart's electrical activity through 12 small electrodes placed on your chest, arms, and legs. You'll get this test in the ambulance if you call 911, which is highly recommended. If an artery feeding your heart is blocked, that chokes off the blood supply to part of your heart muscle. This creates a distinct signature on the EKG. The other main test that is done is a high-sensitivity troponin called an HS troponin test. This blood test measures a protein that rises in response to heart muscle damage. Because elevated levels don't show up right away, you may need to stay for several hours to receive repeat measurements. Other tests that the emergency room doctor may do include a chest x-ray to check for other possible causes of chest discomfort like pneumonia, an echocardiogram, which may reveal changes in your heart's movement resulting from restricted blood flow, and other advanced imaging tests that create detailed pictures of your heart's arteries or the blood flow to your heart. The next article is entitled, Can personality affect heart disease risk? Negative traits like anger and insecurity have been linked to heart-related problems. Taking steps to temper these tendencies may help. Do you remember the type A personality? First coined back in the 1950s, the term refers to people who are aggressive, ambitious, competitive, and time-conscious. But the notion that type A's were more likely to have heart attacks than their more laid-back counterparts turned out to be untrue, as numerous studies in the 1980s and 1990s revealed. But in the early 2000s, another personality type, type D for distressed, began getting more attention. Type D people are anxious, irritable, and angry. They also tend to feel ill at ease in social situations and are uncomfortable opening up to others. According to a 2018 review in Current Cardiology Reports, having a type D personality is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. The lead author, psychologist Johan Denolet, first described type D and created a test for it. And the test is included with this article. Just to mention briefly, the test asks questions like, I make contact easily when I meet people. I often make a fuss about unimportant things. I often talk to strangers. I often feel unhappy. I am often irritated. I take a gloomy view of things, and other tests that are used to distinguish the type D personality. The connection makes sense. The outward manifestation that we call personality influence what's going on biologically at a molecular level, says Dr. Michael Miller, assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. The negative emotions that characterize type D temperaments triggered the body's stress response. Repeated surges of stress hormones in the body can cause blood pressure to rise and make the blood more likely to clot. Stress also activates the immune system, triggering inflammation that damages blood vessels. On the flip side, people with a sunnier, more optimistic personality seem to be less likely to develop heart-related problems. You can see how having a temperament that naturally lends itself to wiser action would lead to a better cardiovascular outcome, says Dr. Miller. People with generally positive outlooks on life also tend to be motivated and productive, he points out. These traits may make it easier to do things that benefit the heart, like getting regular exercise, eating healthy food, and nurturing, supportive relationships with other people. If you have type D tendencies, don't feel disheartened. Many type D people are healthy and function just fine, says Dr. Miller. But for those with heart disease, positive psychology-based programs are promising interventions, according to a scientific statement from the American Heart Association about the mind-heart-body connection, published January 25, 2021 in Circulation. Mindfulness practices, which encourage paying attention to and accepting your emotions moment to moment, can be especially useful for grouchy, irritable people, says Dr. Miller. You can teach yourself to pay attention to feelings that arise in different situations and recognize that you don't have to react. The more you sit and watch it, you realize it's just a state of mind, which can help you put it in perspective, he says. The Harvard Medical School Special Health Report called Positive Psychology has information on mindfulness and related practices. The next article is entitled, Cancer Survivors, a Higher Risk of Heart Problems? And again, this comes from the Harvard Heart Letter, May 2021. Thanks to advances in early detection and treatment, people with cancer are living far longer than in past decades. But cancer survivors should be aware that cancer and its treatments can compromise cardiovascular health, according to a recent study from the CDC. Researchers studied more than 840,000 adults, including about 69,000 cancer survivors, to see how much cancer ages the heart. They found that adult men treated for cancer had hearts that appeared to be 8.5 years older than their actual age, while the hearts of women who survived cancer appeared to be 6.5 years older. The findings support the idea that perhaps the standard methods we use to predict heart disease are not designed for people who've been treated for cancer, says Dr. Tomas Nylén, director of the cardio-oncology program at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. For example, doctors often use an online calculator like the one at www.health.harvard.edu/ASCVD to project a person's chance of having a heart attack or stroke over the next 10 years. The resulting score is used to guide decisions about whether certain people should take a statin to lower their risk. Most people who already have had a heart attack or stroke or who have diabetes should take a statin. The calculator is intended for those without those conditions. Meanwhile, other research is exploring the role of statins during and after cancer treatment. Currently, guidelines suggest that people with risk scores above 5% who also have one or more risk-enhancing factors should consider taking a statin. These risk-enhancing factors include a family history of early heart disease and conditions like chronic kidney disease and rheumatoid arthritis, but not cancer. We may need to think about cancer as a risk-enhancing factor, given what we know about how the disease and its treatments affect the heart, says Dr. Dylan. When he and his colleagues tested the risk calculator in people who had undergone treatment for head and neck cancer, the incidence of heart disease in these patients was 3 times higher than the risk calculator predicted, he says. Cancer and heart disease share some underlying risks, including tobacco use and obesity. However, the results from that study and the one from the CDC took into account traditional heart disease risk factors, including smoking, body mass index, blood pressure, and diabetes, said Dr. Nylén. Tobacco use is well known as a risk for head and neck cancer, which affect the mouth, nose, and throat. But in recent decades, these cancers have been increasingly linked to human papillomavirus, he notes. In recent years, cancer treatment has shifted away from traditional cytotoxic or cell-killing chemotherapy to therapies that target biologic factors that underlie the cancer. Some work by blocking signals that enable cancer cells to grow, while others trigger the immune system to destroy cancer cells. The first immune-based therapy was approved about a decade ago. But today, there are more than 50 potential uses for these therapies, which could be used to treat about 36% of all cancers, says Dr. Nylund. Most are so-called immune checkpoint inhibitors, which frequently cause mild side effects like rash or diarrhea. But sometimes these therapies trigger an autoimmune reaction that attacks various organs, including the heart. This inflammation of the heart, called myocarditis, occurs in only 0.5% to 1% of cases, but has a very high fatality rate. Other possible complications include heart attacks and heart rhythm disorders. Early recognition and intervention can address these heart issues. The reality is, I wouldn't have a job if the oncologists weren't doing such a fantastic job keeping people alive, says Dr. Nylund. The bottom line, if you've been treated for cancer, stay vigilant for any new heart-related symptoms during and after treatment, and report them right away to your primary care physician or oncologist. The most common symptoms include shortness of breath, weakness, fatigue, and rapid, irregular heartbeat. The article also says that observational studies suggest that women already taking statins during chemotherapy for breast cancer are less likely to develop heart failure than those not taking statins. Clinical trials are now underway to further test this observation. Also, a 2015 review article involving a total of nearly 1 million people with cancer found that statin use, either before or after a cancer diagnosis, was linked to improved survival. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I hope you enjoyed it.